Welcome to the Advanced Persistent Security Podcast, where we discuss the world of IT and cybersecurity. Don't be left in the dark about what's going on in the world around you. Here is your host, Joe Gray.
Welcome to yet another episode of the Advanced Persistent Security Podcast. I'm Joe Gray. Before I introduce our guest, I'd like to let you know that the opinions and views expressed in this episode, or any other episode for that matter, do not reflect those of mine or my guests' employers, past, present, and future. Now that that's out of the way, my guest this evening is Ben Shipley. Ben is currently a student studying for his bachelor's degree in information technology with focus in information security. He currently works as an incident handler for a managed security provider. So how's it going, Ben?
It's going great, Joe. How about you?
I can't complain, and to hit my punchline, even if I could, what good would it do?
That's right.
So I've kind of given everybody a rundown about you. Go ahead, fill in any blanks, tell us anything else you want us to know, and then we'll get started with the news.
Well, like you said, I'm currently studying, working on my undergrad in IT with a focus in information security and assurance. Been working in incident response for about 6 or 7 months now.
Awesome. How do you like it so far?
I love it. I feel very fortunate to have a career that is also a hobby.
You know, I say the exact same thing. You probably heard me say it at B-Sides. My philosophy is that if you do what you love, you never work a day in your life. And realistically, I've not worked a day since 2010.
Very fortunate. Trying to get there one day myself.
One foot in front of the other. Just keep that in mind. Anyone who's listening, if you're an aspiring security professional, understand that Rome wasn't built in a day. And understand that, you know, you just have to keep putting one foot in front of the other and continue to stay hungry for information and thirsty for knowledge. And if you're willing to open yourself up to receive the knowledge and the experience, information technology, specifically information security, will be incredibly good to you. So, with that being said, let's go ahead and talk the news. We're only going to hit one story this evening, and then we're going to kick into adventures and incident response. So, our story is about Adult Friend Finder. I feel like this is kind of deja vu from just around, I believe, 13 months ago when Ashley Madison got popped. With that being said, this time it was Adult Friend Finder and the other Friend Finder websites. And in doing so, it also, one thing that you're not seeing in the news, it also took out Penthouse, which honestly, Penthouse is no longer owned by the company who runs the Friend Finder network, but there's still a lot of commonalities. So the information may have been from before the sale back in February 2016. What are your thoughts on this, Ben?
There's a few things that I look at from an IR standpoint that that kind of stand out to me. One, it's kind of hard for me to keep with all the breaches that we see in the media. They seem like they become more and more frequent since I started getting into IT and security. But if my memory serves me, correct me, was Adult Friend Finder not breached within the last year or two?
You know, honestly, I'm not 100% sure about that. I do know that there was a big brouhaha about a vulnerability someone found. I can't recall the name. I'm going to skim the document. Actually, right here it is. So, a researcher known as 1X 0123 or Revolver had found a local file inclusion vulnerability on the site that could allow access to the internal databases. So we don't know anything yet, but it's reasonable that that could have been the vector. And CSO Online reported last month that that this had occurred, and basically a vice president said that the patching had been brought to its attention. But if I recall correctly, without reading ultimately into this, which I just saw that it said it fixed a vulnerability, I want to think that they said that it was a feature, not a vulnerability.
I think that's always a scapegoat, isn't that?
That
or a nation state.
Oh, I was about to say that. I guess we got to take a drink. Either that or the cybers. But,
there you go.
But, you know, this kind of coincides perfectly at the time we're recording, because I just recently published a blog post called The Security of Porn, which talked about how Pornhub was really good with availability and proactive in security, maintaining a bug bounty program. So it seems like porn has their stuff together. It seems like hookup and dating sites don't necessarily have that same claim to fame, really.
I think these sites are a lot more popular than what people would willingly admit, which I think is... there's going to be greater impact from this than what people would think. I mean, obvious thing that I've seen make the rounds is the number of government email addresses associated with this breach.
I fully expect a breakdown in the next 2600 magazine to tell us how many .gov and .mil email addresses were in the breach. And I've already seen some numbers based on what was seen out on one of the websites that actually provides it. I think it was Leaked Source, which I don't condone going to it. If you do so, understand you're doing it at your own will. You are solely liable for that if you decide to go there. So, you know, in doing so, again, I'm surprised. Well, apparently they actually did validate email addresses with this. So, unlike Ashley Madison, there doesn't seem to be any B. Obama at whitehouse.govs in this one that we know of yet. But I'm looking at a list of the passwords, the top 10 that were pulled from it. And this is absolutely disturbing, because there's none that are vulgar, unlike Ashley Madison. The top 10 for Ashley Madison had a few vulgar ones in it. This one doesn't. So I'm going to go through the top 5 and just prepare yourself. I will go over what the password is and then the frequency. And if anyone wants to read along, this is on tripwire.com in their state of security and the data breach report by Graham Cluley. So, number one is 123456. The frequency is 900,420. Wow. Number two, 12345. 635,995. Next, we have the more secure version. 123456789. That is 585,150. Next, we have 123456789. That one dropped off to 145,867. And rounding out number five, with the most secure of the five, is 123456789 0. At 133,414. Probably the most secure password on the list was number 9, which is QWERTY, IUOP, which is the top row of the keyboard. That came in at number 9 with a frequency of 43,755. So, did these people not learn anything from Ashley Madison? Really?
I mean, clearly, and I think good OBSEC would tell you just to use ASDFGHJKLSIM, but it's a common thing, and I don't know if it's a password management problem or security fatigue. Last year for Cybersecurity Awareness Month at the university, the Offensive Security Research Club did a focus on password management. And one of the things we did was at all the campuses, we printed off huge posters with the most commonly used passwords and just put it up in the main walkways. And you would be amazed by how many people stopped and were like, oh my God, that's my password. So I think it comes down to a convenience versus security problem. We can preach strong password security all day long, but when it comes to repetitiveness, people are always going to opt for what they know.
And I agree completely with you on this topic specifically. So, you know, one thing to keep in mind, this is a cultural issue. People are going to do whatever they can to get access, and get it quickly, and they don't want to have to remember 50,000 passwords. We're not, as an industry, we're not putting enough emphasis on finding a solution to the problem. We're busy pointing out the problem. And we already have a semi-solution available via password managers and password vaults. So, you know, you've got LastPass, KeePass, 1Password, the list goes on. And they all essentially perform the same function. You know, they have a little bit different bells and whistles, but honestly, they pretty much do the exact same thing. So, you know, it is what it is. But realistically, we need to put more emphasis and make them a little bit more widespread and mainstream that people understand them. I'm not telling the companies who run those three pieces of software what to do, but it might be a good time to start taking out TV advertisements. So, you know, I wish I could say that it would be nice if we could have, you know, a single password we used everywhere. As a society, we are not at that level of maturity within cybersecurity. Yep, take a drink. To be able to do that. So, you know, right now our next most viable solution is password managers. So, to do a little research on my own password manager, I now know that I have 100 accounts in there. That's not to say I have 100 accounts total, because I know I have far more. There's some that I don't have in there. I'm eventually going to migrate them there. I'm just waiting because upon some occasion, they, you know, like some of them require two-factor authentication, like Google Authenticator or an RSA token. And honestly, that's going to solve this problem with people being able to get into websites and do things like this to a degree. I understand it's not the only vector. No one should imply that that's what I said, but that would definitely slow it down. And it would somewhat protect the users that are subjected to these data breaches, because as a user, I don't care what website it is. I don't care what the purpose of the website is. If I'm giving you information to allow me to sign into your website, I have a certain expectation that you will be a good steward of my data. And by you getting continuously breached and my username and password put out on the dark web or wherever, that is not being a good steward. And I have a problem with that. So we need to get that awareness out there for password managers. They're not hard to use. You pay for it. You set up a file local to a computer. And if you so choose in iCloud or Dropbox, you can have it on your mobile device. You allow it to generate passwords. And these passwords are not human readable. Can they still be broken? Well, of course. You know, with enough time, processing power, and resources, anything can be. But the thing is, you, like with a specific password manager I use, I can generate a 660, that is, character password. And I can complicate it as much as I would like to include letters, symbols, upper, lower, and then I can even use ambiguous characters as well. I have an app on my phone, so I can copy and paste that password and put it into whatever application it is on my phone as well. It honestly makes life a lot easier. I can't rapidly log into accounts like LinkedIn or Facebook, but, you know, someone can't go and collect open source intelligence. Yeah, you're listening to the Advanced Persistent Security Podcast. You knew it was going to come up. People can't go out and gather open source intelligence about me and guess my password anymore. And some of the other features within the password manager, they even allow me to come up with bogus password reset answers. So for some websites, you don't even have, like, you could try, you could gather all the information, and you can't reset my password because I lied. Sue me.
Right. And, you know, just another tip as well is when you have these authentication questions for your password where it's like, oh, what was the name of your first dog or your kindergarten teacher? You don't have to actually put a name there. Just put a random phrase, and good luck guessing that.
It's not like you're taking out an auto loan and they're going to call and check references.
Right.
Right now, we're still a little bit in the dark about the full sequence of events. If I recall, with Ashley Madison, it took about 2 to 3 weeks for all the details to come out. So I do see a lot of parallels between the two. On Sophos' website, their Naked Security blog, they even say that 15.7 million of the database accounts were actual deleted accounts that had not been properly purged. Another thing that they mention in there is that 125 million of the accounts, keep in mind that the total number is 412 million. Yeah, 412 and then six zeros. 125 million, so in essence, about 25% were using SHA-1, which is pretty much easy to crack. If you've got the processing power and the time, John the Ripper is exceptionally fast. Hashcat is exceptionally fast when it comes to this. And that's not even using GPU. So in doing so, you know, it's unacceptable, especially considering that there are algorithms out there like Blowfish implemented in Bcrypt or even Scrypt that would allow you to have a more secure method of storing these passwords. At least they were encrypted. I can give them at least that much.
They were, but, you know, I'm just looking at some stuff right here. So we know that 412 million accounts, according to not leaked source, came from Adult Friend Finder and some other sites affiliated with it. And like you just said, it's going to take a few weeks to get the full scope of everything. But I'm looking right now, and there's 116 different websites pointing to the same IP address as Adult Friend Finder. And it's all similar dating stuff or porn sites. So I'm curious to see which accounts might be not affiliated with Adult Friend Finder that are gonna come up as well. And also to get back to the .gov or .mil email addresses, at what point do we start looking at negligence for the network admins or sysadmins on these government mail servers? Are you not paying attention to data that's coming inbound or outbound on these mail servers? Because that seems like an incident in itself.
And I totally agree. Realistically, just because they're registering with those accounts don't necessarily mean they're accessing it on a government computer. That being said, they probably are. And I'm not in a position to speak either way because I have no inside knowledge of it. My last interaction with dealing with the military information system as active duty was 2010. As a contractor on a government site was 2013. So I really can't speak to that. But if you make it to where the emails are undeliverable, they'll sign up with a different account. Why are we not applying the same blocking mechanisms? You know, we have it in line where we block certain websites. Why do we not apply that same principle to incoming emails? We do that. We block specific domains when they're known for malware, spam, phishing, or whatever. Why do we not do it when it's something that's not work-related? You know, there's absolutely zero reason for someone to be receiving emails at work from Adult Friend Finder, unless they work at Adult Friend Finder.
I agree wholeheartedly, which is why I brought it up. You know, if they use that email address to sign up for the account, that's where the email confirmation is going to. So why wouldn't you have a policy in place to block stuff like that? I mean, for how long has porn sites been affiliated with distribution of malware, etc.? You know, you probably have a policy in place to block porn on your proxy. Why not your mail servers?
Exactly. Well, I mean, on the intrusion detection system, I have specific experience having used SourceFire. And one of the services that they bundle with SourceFire IDS in certain packages is called URL filtering. Coincidentally, it filters URLs. And in doing so, you can specify by website type, by context, or whatever. Furthermore, I created a rule that allowed all traffic to all websites within specific top-level domains that we had to access, right? I specifically put an implicit block on known malicious top-level domains and top-level domains that served absolutely no purpose for work. One of those was .xxx. So, again, to echo what you've said, why not do it to the mail filter? Well, I think I have an answer. And this is not me being a Linux or Unix supremacist, because I'm really not. You know, I'm not a supremacist when it comes to operating systems, but I am going to speak a little bit based on my experience in dealing with some Windows administrators. I think that the level of work that would be required to accomplish this exceeds the amount that they would normally do. Alternatively, a lot of organizations don't have dedicated Exchange admins, depending on the size of the organization. So if you're having to worry about managing Active Directory and the associated DNS, DHCP that goes with that, alongside a VPN concentrator and Exchange and these other workstations or servers, okay, that might be a valid reason, but workload really is no excuse for not implementing security. Understanding that you have to triage what you're doing, there comes a time that you actually have to do it. And if you can do it via group policy, then it's even easier. For something like this, if you want to implement it, you just as easily could hire a contractor to create it for you and then implement it for you and just do a temporary engagement. Not to say that this is the biggest thing, because honestly, it's more of company embarrassment than anything. But with incoming porn, then yeah, that definitely does create other problems. You know, I'm going to try to keep from beating that horse to death. But, you know, now we have to worry about password reuse again. And going back to password managers, if you're using a password manager, there's no excuse for password reuse.
This is true. And, you know, like you and other security leaders in the industry whose podcasts I listen to, this has been an ongoing issue. And you hear people like, oh, Google or Yahoo is going to kill the password, and it's been proven that that's just a bad idea. The password still has a very important purpose within security or authentication. And at what point, I wonder, do we just accept this as the cost of doing business? And let's see.
Honestly, I'll just chime in on this right now as well about the password thing. So when you talk about authentication, you're talking about something you have, something you know, something you are, right? Implementing the infrastructure and replacing legacy systems so that you can use things like smart cards and tokens and what have you, that can be costly. And then you have to worry about people stealing the tokens. And then, you know, if you're dealing with smart cards, you have to worry about people stealing the smart cards, losing the smart cards, the cost of the smart cards. And then, you know, it doesn't alleviate the problem with authentication because someone can still say, hey, here's my card, here's the PIN, go work for me. So anyway, with that as well, you know, something you are, the biometric perspective of it, something you are, that's hard to get user people to really buy into because they feel it's a violation of their privacy and invasive. So that makes it hard. And again, it's expensive. It's very expensive. And then you have to deal with things like your false acceptance rate and your false rejection rate. You know, anyone who studied the CISSP knows what a crossover error rate is. And in that regard, you know, it's a constant level. It's a constant balance of how sensitive is too sensitive, but we have to have some sensitivity or it's just going to allow everyone in. So basically that leaves something you know, which, okay, that's a password or a passphrase. It's been around since the beginning of time. It's interoperable between systems. So realistically, you know, passwords, I hate to say it, people, you can quote me on this, you can get mad, but they're basically here to stay. What we have to worry about now, there's two things we can do to make the world a better place in the realm of passwords. Implement password managers and make two-factor authentication a thing. And when I say a thing, more universally accepted. Things like Google Authenticator, RSA Secure Tokens, which is also expensive, but you know, Google Authenticator is free. Alternatively, there's another alternative app, authentication app. I actually use it for some of my stuff. It's called Clef, and I think it's getclef.com. But anyway, what it is think of it as multi-factor, as in something you have. So I don't enter a username or a password, but whenever I get to the logon screen, it displays basically a waveform. And this waveform, I pull up the app on my phone, I authenticate to my phone using biometrics, so there's your second factor. Alternatively, there's a PIN if my biometrics don't work. So, redundant measure. And basically, these waveform syncs, it sends a message back to Clef. Clef says yes or no. And I get in or I don't. I like that. I really wish that that would be a little bit more widespread, because you really can't keylog a waveform. You can't keylog what a camera on a phone is seeing.
No, I suppose you can't, but with the camera on the thing, on the phone, does that not kind of delve into more of a biometric verification?
Well, that's the thing. It is multi-factor authentication, because it's something you have because you're pointing the phone at your computer screen. So, you know, your phone's camera is looking to it, the camera is capturing what is on your computer screen. So it's not looking at you. But the biometric perspective of it is, I use my fingerprint to authenticate to the app. So you have to authenticate to the app via a fingerprint or a PIN, and then from there the waveforms sync via the camera, and then your phone sends the signal, and then the token comes to the computer.
Oh, wow, that's actually pretty interesting.
I'll show it to you tomorrow at the conference. So it's going to be too late for me to plug it by the time this comes out, but tomorrow, November 16th, at the Laudermilk Center, I will be doing a Sans Coins Community of Interest in Networking and Security presentation for Security 504, the Hacker Tools, Techniques, Exploits, and Incident Handling course. And I'm really looking forward to it. I'll be co-presenting with Dustin Lee. We have the morning session, and then the afternoon session is Joe Vest doing web application pen testing. He is the technical editor of the book RTFM, the Red Team Field Manual. So definitely looking forward to that. But, you know, at this point, we've kind of beat the horse of Adult Friend Finder and passwords to death. So at this point, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to start discussing adventures and incident response. Stay tuned.
Are you looking for a place to advertise to the unique audience of IT security professionals and enthusiasts? Look no further. Advanced Persistent Security is seeking sponsors. This slot could be yours. Contact sales at advancedpersistentsecurity.net for more information.
And we're back from the break. Thank you for sticking around. I want to reiterate before we get started on adventures and incident response, the opinions and views expressed in this podcast are mine and Ben's alone. They do not reflect those of our employers, past, present, and future. We will be talking incident response, so we may end up talking things that we have seen with that. Know that these are based on theoretic scenarios and do not resemble any interaction that we've had in real life. These are theoretical situations that we have heard from friends. With that being said, Ben, I know you wanted to talk about this, so I'm going to give you the floor to get things started.
Yeah, sure, Joe. I guess I wanted to kind of ask you, just given your background, when dealing or I guess working in incident response for a prolonged period of time, do you find it common where you kind of get in a zone of you're always looking for a threat, and you know, over time you start to see stuff always as a threat and come to find out that it's not actually a threat? You know, I personally had an incident with that this week, which, you know, I guess you could always say a false positive is better than a false negative. But this particular incident happened to pull time and resources away from other team members. And, you know, like I said, at the end of the day, it really ended up being it was still an actual incident, but a very minor one at that. It probably didn't require the amount of resources that ended up getting devoted to it. So how do you, if you've encountered this problem before, how do you go about remaining vigilant, I guess, and, you know, staying alert and being able to separate the, you know, the high threats from the menial stuff?
It's kind of like whenever you're at the perfume counter and you're sniffing the different colognes, and in between sniffs you sniff the coffee beans to kind of cleanse your nasal cavity of the previous aroma, or when you're doing wine tasting and you have your palate cleansers. Basically, you've just got to set those mental boundaries. Realistically, there's not a whole lot wrong with the idea that you're a little trigger happy in classifying something an incident. Now, when you're talking about a significant deviance in time and resources from other more pressing incidents, that does become problematic if it's a recurring thing. But from time to time, I would definitely rather kill something with napalm than, you know, let it poison me, so to speak. So, you know, honestly, I don't know if there is a right answer for this. With remaining vigilance, you've just got to maintain that no two incidents are the same, as no two events are the same. You know, the difference between an event and an incident is, you know, an incident's very problematic in nature. It wasn't necessarily intended to happen, and it poses a threat to the organization. So, you know, with an event, that could be something like system log on, system log off, system crash, reboot, accessing a database. All logs are full of events. Events are not bad, but incidents, you know, you've got to be able to triage. And I agree with, you know, that whole thing, sure. But, you know, honestly, I don't really have a solid, you know, thought-provoking answer for how one would completely separate themselves from something. With that being said, I would say, you know, you gain a lot through experience and research. You know me personally, you know how much time I'm spending doing research, writing blogs, recording podcasts, reading. You could probably attest to the statement that I have two speeds, asleep and security.
Right.
You know, that's really the only thing. You know, you've got to devote yourself to it and really just gain the chops. But, you know, when you're looking at everything and the sentiment is everything here is an incident, then, you know, yeah, I see exactly where that tunnel vision comes from. And, you know, in past lives, I did the monitoring side, not necessarily, you know, in a SOC, monitoring packets as they come through, running PCAPs and what have you. But, you know, I did review logs, I did review SIM data and do assessments on systems and look for anomalies and what have you. And when you find one, it does heighten your sense of alertness, and it does make you a little bit more prone to say, oh, everything is an incident. So, I mean, I wish there was a better answer, but the best one I can come up with right now is probably experience and maturity.
You know, just from, you know, my personal standpoint, it was, you know, if there was time and resources from other coworkers devoted to this, it was, I feel like it leaves the potential for another incident to go unnoticed. It could have been possibly a greater threat to a company. And I mean, you know, I feel like that's bad.
And you are correct. It is bad. But here's the thing. Did you learn something from it?
I did.
Did the time and resources pulled away from other stuff that helped respond to this learn something?
I would like to think so.
I wouldn't consider it a complete wash then, because I'm gonna quote Helio Gracie, the founder of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, the martial art. You either win or you learn. Don't count failure as how many times you don't succeed. Count it as how many times you didn't learn.
It's good logic.
Something terrible could have happened to someone else, But in hindsight, it didn't. Honestly, within the organization, you could have, if something did start to happen elsewhere that was a little bit higher on the severity level, I'm sure, you know, other resources could have been applied to it as well. You know, pulling a few people away from something for a false positive is not going to topple an entire organization's infrastructure, right?
No, it didn't do that, but I mean, I guess you could say it definitely toppled your ego, if that's a thing. You kind of feel like you get the rolling eye effect of people, and they're just like, really, dude? Really?
Welcome to working in information security. There are times that I've given training or had conversations with coworkers or spoken up in meetings, and I could just hear the eyes rolling in the back of people's heads because they're like, oh God, it's a security guy talking again. Will he just shut up? I want to go back to my desk and go back to watching Twitter and pinning things on Pinterest. But at the end of the day, you know, that kind of comes with the territory of being a security professional. And basically, you know, experience and maturity is about the only prescription for that. And the good thing that comes along with that is, you know, you learn from it. And when you see that again, you know, you're going to be a little bit more cautious about bringing in those additional time and those additional resources. But the thing about it is, you know, you're going to have a different perspective to look at it with. And at the end of the day, even people might roll their eyes at you, but when something happens and you come to the rescue or, you know, perform under pressure, they'll be happy to know you.
So you're saying basically just take this one on the chin and remember it as a lesson learned.
That's exactly what I'm saying, because if I were in your shoes, that's exactly what I would do. I'll give you an example of something I did that's it's borderline embarrassing. I mean, it wasn't the end of the world. It wasn't a giant incident response type thing. It was quasi-incident response, but, you know. So, I had started a new job. We had not gotten our vulnerability scanner yet. And this organization was a little bit lacking in the security field. There were a lot of things wrong. A lot of things changed rapidly once I got in and saw exactly how bad it was. Anyway, so, until we got the vulnerability scanner, I downloaded Nmap and was running some Nmap scans across the network. Okay, no problem. What could go wrong there, right? Well, this host pops for having port, I think it was like 14.2000 or 14.200. I don't remember exactly what port it was, but I looked it up because it was one that I wasn't familiar with. You know, it wasn't 53, 443, 88, 67, any of those, right? I was like, this one doesn't exactly look familiar. What is it? So I looked it up, and the website I went to said it was Trinu, some malware. So I immediately go over and do incident response. And this is before I really knew what incident response was and how to properly do it. You know, in hindsight, if I were to do it again, I should have completely scrubbed it off the network and taken it, isolated it, and had some fun with it. But I didn't. And the maturity of this organization's security just wasn't there yet either. So if I had have tried that then, it probably wouldn't have went over very well. But anyway, I went to the machine. I started doing some analysis. And then I started running a couple of tools to correlate processes running with ports. And did some netstat. I confirmed it was still running. Well, here's what I found out. The machine didn't have Trinu. There was no Trinu to be found. The same port was Dropbox. The person had the Dropbox open to listen to music. I went doom and gloom. The sky is falling. Full Chicken Little. Honestly, in hindsight, I was pretty embarrassed. But you know what? I learned from it. Take it on the chin. And, you know, you didn't win this time, but you learned. And in my opinion, oftentimes that's more important.
Did you immediately block Dropbox to teach them a lesson?
I tried. Management said no, but I did successfully abolish use of thumb drives. Got another story coming up about that, but yeah, that was kind of problematic. And, you know, I had a similar situation. I was trying to apply group policy. I'd never done that before. The Windows administrators weren't exactly being helpful in doing so. I didn't do it properly. I didn't follow the instructions. Instead of doing it in GP edit, I believe I was doing it in the registry. I was as green as the day was long. But, you know, they were supposed to be helping me, but they conveniently had training and had their doors shut. And, you know, I may or may not have been able to hear them talking to their spouse on the phone through the wall. But, hey, you know, who am I to judge? But in doing so, I didn't know that the system administrators had a external hard drive connected to the domain controllers whenever I rebooted them to get the changes to apply. Well, here's the thing. That was the only DNS server for the entire infrastructure, so the entire website went down, public and internal.
Oh, I bet that went over real well.
But we all know the song 99 Lead Balloon, or 99 Red Balloons. This went over like 99 Lead Balloons. And, you know, at this point, it was like, come on, Joe, you're a security guy. You know better than this. It's like, well, you know better than to leave a stupid external hard drive connected all night. It's like, we were running backups. It's like, okay, well, why didn't you tell somebody? So, I mean, it just turned into a giant finger-pointing session. And at the end of the day, I think we were all about equally as wrong, and I'm not going to hate on that. I'm not going to say anything one way or another because I own it. But at the same time, it was a learning experience. You bet the next time that I went and rebooted the domain controllers, and every time after that, I went and physically touched them and verified there were no USB connected devices. And as another learning experience, the organization actually established a secondary DNS server internally off of the Windows platform so that they could actually achieve split-split, which allowed internal DNS queries, and it alleviated the internal host from having to directly touch an internet DNS provider. There was some positive that came out of that as well. Sit tight. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll continue the discussion. Stay tuned.
Are you subscribed to this podcast? If not, please do so on iTunes and at advancedpersistentsecurity.net/podcast.
Attention security professionals. Have you been looking for a community of only security experts? Look no further. PeerList is here. PeerList helps you stay on top of the news by creating personalized feeds where you get posts from your community and blogs from top industry bloggers, all customized to your specific interests. No more email lists to discuss a topic with other experts. You can invite specific people to any discussion, as well as contribute to any discussion on PeerList. Build your reputation by creating a profile and contributing content that will help others see your expertise. The better your content is, the higher you rank. PeerList never gives your information to any vendor. You are not a lead. You are a professional. Check out PeerList today at peerlist.com. PeerlyST.com.
And we're back. So we've discussed the Adult Friend Finder data breach. We've talked a lot about passwords. And then we talked about some adventures in incident response. So at this point, we're going to kind of do something different. Since we've kind of had all the adventures in incident response that we really wanted to have this spectacular evening on the eve of my crash course tomorrow. This is going to be a belly aching session. And the belly aching session is a place where we can belly ache about what's bothering us in the world of information security in a respectful and healthy manner. You know, to kind of start out, as you may have heard, I am diabetic. I think I mentioned it on a previous podcast. And I was transferring some prescriptions to a pharmacy today, and they asked me if I had the pharmacy card, and my response was no. Well, they informed me that instead of paying full price for these prescriptions, given that right now I'm in a period of not having insurance due to starting a new job and having to wait for it to take effect, obviously I can't go without certain medications because of diabetes. I jumped at the opportunity because it was instant savings. I instantly saved more than I would have spent. You know, instead of spending $50 on one prescription and I think $35 on the other, I paid $20 for the discount card and I got both of them for $5 each. So, okay, that's a win. Well, the thing is, when enrolling in this card for this pharmacy, it forced me to opt in to third-party marketing. And the problem that comes with that is I looked for an opt-out button. I hit cancel and I had to restart the process all over again. My belly aching is, why is it that pharmacies or organizations in general think that it's okay to elicit certain amounts of information out of their customers to share with people, and they don't give their customers the opportunity to opt out? That's what I'm belly aching about right this moment. What about you, Ben?
Well, buddy, I'd say you picked the right one, because I am willing to bet I know that exact pharmacy as someone who has recently experienced that themselves. And it is a huge personal problem for me, where you force people's hand at sacrificing their privacy. You know, you hear people say, "Oh, well, you don't have to use those apps, or you don't have to use this service," but at the end of the day, you do. I went to go get a prescription filled, and they told me the same thing. It's like, "Oh, do you got your prescription card?" I was like, "Nope." They're like, "Oh, do you want to go sign up for one?" You know, it's like a store, you know, points card. And I said, no, I'm good. And they're like, "Well, you have to sign up for it to get your prescription." And I was like, "Why?" You know, and it's like, "Oh, it's store policy." And I don't really believe that to be store policy, but it's a culture-based thing for me. These people who work in these retail outlets and things like that, it is a key performance indicator for them for the number of signups that they get. And, you know, I'm sure, as you know, or any data scientists out there know, that data is getting sold off. And every company's doing it. Somebody's buying it and compiling all that data and building out a unique profile about people for the sole purpose of targeting advertisements towards them for a unique experience. And I mean, me personally, I'm ready to just say, you know, enough is enough already. It's not necessary. Just let me pay you cash money and let me keep my data. Same thing with cell phones. You almost have to have a cell phone this day and age. You know, as a matter of fact, when I was registering for the ISSA conference today, you know, they want a phone number there. I mean, they don't have to verify it or put a fake number in, whatever. But not everybody's going to be as vigilant, if you will, about that. They're more likely than not going to put their actual phone number in there and their actual mailing address. And Joe, what do you think is going to happen from there? They're going to get a whole litany of spam.
Oh yeah. There's going to be all sorts of good stuff. So, you know, I'm going to back up for just a moment about the whole reward card thing. And you hit the nail on the head about the marketing aspect of it, because I did do some limited coursework in a business intelligence program. So I'm familiar with how to properly do data mining, how to properly do regression and cluster analysis, which are the two core algorithms of insurance and retail. With that being said, they have a certain amount of information that is mandated that they collect to be your pharmacy, right? So if you compound it with all this other stuff and they force your hand to consent to something, now they have your consent to run this regression and cluster analysis. And what that's going to do is that's going to shape the circulars that your neighborhood receives. So now, theoretically, people who live in the part of the Atlanta metro area that I live in could potentially receive circulars with discounts on it for things like alcohol pads, diabetic test strips, socks, because, you know, diabetics always like to wear socks. We're supposed to, but I like flip-flops. But things like that, we're going to get compiled into a massive database. Regression analysis is going to occur, and then they're going to determine what is the best method of which to market to us. And it's funny that, you know, we should go on this tangent, because I saw on Twitter yesterday someone was buying motor oil on Walmart's website, and it suggested that they bought Red Bull with it. And granted, it was an information security professional, so it probably wasn't wrong. With that being said, they were bellyaching on Twitter, "Hey, why is Walmart doing this to me?" It's like, well, it's because people who are in your area that buy that type and size of motor oil typically buy 6 cans of Red Bull. Simple. You know, and I cited, hey, you know, Target outed a girl for being pregnant before she even knew she was pregnant. How did that happen? Well, it's simple. Her shopping habits changed, and they had their data science so fine-tuned that they knew what pregnant women bought. That's exactly how they outed her. But that was an awkward conversation at the dinner table with her dad. What kills me in the same vein? You're at the pet food store, you buy a bag of dog food, you know, a $60 bag of dog food, because my dogs are pampered and they have sensitive tummies, and, you know, they get organic, grain-free dog food. But anyway, they're like, "What's your phone number? Why do you need it?" Okay, why do you need it? Awkward silence. Do you have to put it in? Oh, no, I don't. Okay, well, then I'm not going to provide it.
Right.
And then, and if the response is, I do have to have it, and they don't have a valid reason for it, my response, I'm going to put this in so many people's ears just because I'm sadistic like that. My phone number, if you want to know, is 678-867-5309.
And commence the robo-dialing.
Oh, they can robo-dial all they want, but they're just going to get Jenny. You know, Jenny at 867-5309.
I'm sure somebody out there has that as an actual number.
I feel sorry for them. I'll tell you once we're done recording about a story of a teacher who had an interesting phone number that was a mainstay of prank calls in the summer.
You should share it on the show.
No. Anyway, with that being said, though, you know, I hate it when you go to a store and the store is allowing people to be, quote-unquote, surveying in the store. And they're like, hey, you want to fill this out? There's a $500 gift certificate to Fruit of the Loom underwear store. Well, no. Number one, I don't wear Fruit of the Loom underwear. Number two, I'm not giving you my data. Actually, you know what? I will sign up if you can tell me exactly what you're going to do with this data. Well, we're going to draw names. Okay, that's cool. You're going to draw names. I understand you're going to do that. You made that abundantly clear. So with all the records in here, the winners and the losers, what are you going to do with that? Are you going to just throw them away? Well, no, I've got to take them back to headquarters. Okay, and then what's going to happen there? I don't know. Okay, yeah, I'm not signing up because I'll tell you exactly what's going to happen. I'm going to start receiving phone calls and emails and other marketing materials from you guys. You're going to annoy me, and I'm going to have to unsubscribe from you. The people in this specific scenario were like, I don't think that's what's going to happen. I was like, I'm sorry, dude. I work in information security, and I, at the time, was actually in class. I had just finished my data mining class. I was like, I'm actually working on a graduate certificate in business intelligence and big data. That's exactly what you're going to do. You just don't know it.
Right. The other side to that is when you voice these concerns or, you know, your personal beliefs on the matter, you kind of get scoffed at, or you get the rolling eyes, you know, they're like, oh, okay, tinfoil guy, you know, why don't you go dodge some chemtrails while you're at it too? And
yeah, you become the bad guy. Right. It's like, sorry, dude, there's no tinfoil here. I mean, it is what it is. And, you know, I'm going to take this for an interesting turn because I am, you know, interested in this angle and dynamic. But as a social engineer or an OSINT practitioner, imagine the wealth of data you could get, not necessarily posing as someone doing a survey, but hanging around someone doing a survey. The conversations. And, I mean, this is, I mean, you can get this anywhere, really. You don't have to be waiting for people to do a survey. But, you know, you could easily, while they're not looking, just start stealing names out of the hat or whatever, right? Picking up on the conversation. You know, imagine the plethora of data that comes with this. I would honestly be curious as to when you do sign up for these things in stores, after they get all your information into their database, I would be curious as to how they dispose of it.
That's what I was going to bring up. You kind of beat me to the punch. As somebody who spent a good amount of time working in retail, I would tell you that you would not be happy about that. More often than not, you know, if they're not aware of what is going to come as a result of collecting that data on behalf of their company, they're probably not practicing, you know, a good, I guess, for lack of a better term, clean desk policy in regard to protecting that data.
Good, basically, good OPSEC and being a good steward of the data is how I would characterize it. But yeah, and I have a feeling that the answer you would provide has something to do with something that I could look at on Google Maps and possibly buy a pair of coveralls and go digging through. And even if I got caught, I could easily say I was doing maintenance, correct?
Correct. Right.
Clever.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and, you know, with the whole OSINT or social engineering perspective of this, a very simple pretext to be able to get good information out of people. You know someone at your target organization shops somewhere. What do? Well, $500 gift certificate to Amazon, whether you have it or not. I mean, people don't check up on these things either because they just assume they're going to lose.
No, and, you know, let's say, for instance, you know, I'm sure more and more of these stores are going to entering this data strictly on the computer, but a good amount of them are still doing this through like a you know, trifold or paper brochure,
mm-hmm.
and that stuff is laying around. So let's just say me as threat actor, or whatever you want to call it, collects these paper folders that were just left laying around, you know, maybe somebody went on break and just left it at the register or whatever. A lot of times, what is that going to have, Joe? It's going to have the person's name, address, email address, and phone number. And if you're at this particular store or outlet, you know where they shopped. So how hard would it be for you to send a phishing email to these people saying that, hey, this is, you know, Joe's Electronics. You've won a $5 trillion Amazon gift card. Click this link to come collect it.
Four words. Winner, winner, chicken dinner. But, you know, honestly, I would be interested in doing some actual formal research, you know, utilizing pure scientific research to set up a couple of people as people who are running a survey or a contest, and to see how many people actually sign up for it and how much information you can talk out of them while there's some random person just standing behind them. And if I were to run this survey or whatever, I would be asking really, you know, really juicy questions. Like, I actually thought about this when I was working on my doctorate that I haven't finished. And, you know, some of the questions I was thinking about asking were like, hey, where did you grow up? Oh, that's cool. That's cool. So did you go to school there? Okay, that's awesome. What's your mom's name? What was her name before she got married? Oh, do you have a dog? What's your favorite name for a dog? Was there a specific teacher that you really liked in high school? You know, did you get hot for teacher on any teachers? And, you know, just ask those questions and see if people actually answer them. Because if I've posed them a specific way, if you go back and listen to how I posed them, I basically asked you almost every password reset question. And the ones I didn't ask, I can take the information you provided and find out via public records, Ancestry.com, or other OSINT platforms.
Right. And was it Jimmy Fallon or Jimmy Kimmel?
It was one of the two. I do recall seeing it, actually.
Where they were getting people to tell them their password?
Yeah, know? They just straight up said, hey, what's your password? And honestly, I would probably be like, okay, well, hey, flip over to the other side. And the other side of this would probably be, what's your password? So, you know, I would be interested to do it. And I understand there are some ethical implications that come with this. But honestly, you know, there's a lot of really interesting aspects that come with it. And I would just be curious to know how many people are actually going to give up that data.
I would say it would be a staggering majority of people would give up that data.
You're probably right, and I think
especially the younger the demographic, the more willing they seem to be in regard to giving up that information.
That could be the case. And, you know, if I were to do that type of study, I would try to go to several different areas. You know, I would try to target different age groups and different demographics. Like, I might go to, say, the grocery store around the 3rd, 4th, or 5th of the month. If I were going for people on, say, Social Security, because they get their checks the 3rd of the month, right? Alternatively, if there's a cool indie band playing or PBR sales, I'd go and try to get the younger generation, you know, the millennials, the hipsters, if you will. I would try to do it almost universally across the board just to see how it would pan out. And honestly, if anyone's interested in sponsoring this study, email podcast@advancedpersistentsecurity.com, because I would love to talk to you about it. Otherwise, you know, you have to get permission to do this, and you have to explain to the organization why you're doing it. And if you're not doing sponsored or academic research, the chances of getting told yes are slim to none. And even if you are doing sponsored or academic research, that's probably still what you're going to hear. When I thought about doing that study as part of my doctorate, I wanted to try to get formal permission to do it at the Atlanta airport, because you get such a hodgepodge of people. Granted, you know, they all have the one thing in common. They fly through Atlanta, and, you know, they do meet certain demographics if they're flying all over the place. But you get people from all over the world of all shapes, sizes, everything. That would be a good place to do it, in my opinion.
I think so. And if you ask the question on where their final destination is or their originating destination, you could maybe even do a deeper dive into analyzing the I guess, security awareness of specific regions around the globe as well, which I would personally find interesting.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the level of inference that you could do with this, just based on where they're flying to or from, even analysis on their names, there's so much that could be done and so much open source intelligence to be gathered about it. You know, it's the possibilities are near endless. So I really wish that, you know, someone would sponsor this so I can find out. So, again, if you're interested, email podcast@advancedpersistentsecurity.net. On that note, we're going to take our final break, and when we come back, Ben's going to tell us how to contact him if he wants to be contacted, and then we'll say goodbye. Stay tuned.
Don't forget to check out our blog at advancedpersistentsecurity.net/blog. Follow us on Twitter at @ADVPersistentSEC. And follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/advancedpersistentsecurity.
Attention listeners, have you ever been interested in recording a podcast of your own, whether it be information security, technology, cooking, or even flags? Look no further. Zencastr is here. Zencastr is a cloud-based online solution that provides each guest with a separate track. WAV files, built-in voiceover IP, cloud drive integration, automatic post-production, and a soundboard for live editing. If you are interested, go to zencastr.com, ZENCASTR.com, and enter coupon code APSPODCAST20 for a 20% discount. Once again, that is Zencastr, ZENCASTR.com. I hope to listen to you soon. And we're back. Thank you for joining us through this episode. So through the course of this conversation, we have discussed the Adult Friend Finder data breach. We've discussed passwords. We've went over some adventures and incident response. Then we went through a bellyache session where we talked about data. Data in terms of surveys and questionnaires and just data handling. What happens to data when you give it to people and organizations? And honestly, I think the outcome would be rather scary. So with that being said, all great things must come to an end. The same can be said for this podcast. So at this point, Ben, I'm going to give you the floor. Tell us how to contact you if you want to be contacted, any parting pieces of words, wisdom, advice, and then say goodbye.
If you want to reach out to me, I guess the best way to do so would be via Twitter. My Twitter handle is @infosexual. That's info, SECSUAL.
And he is bald, just like good old Jerry Bell. If you look at the tweet that he has mentioned in from B-Sides Atlanta. So, Ben, do you have any parting pieces of advice or anything to say to the audience before we say goodbye?
Yeah, use Tinder and not Adult Friend Finder, I guess. They haven't been breached yet, have they?
Not to my knowledge.
No, but all jokes aside, seriously, use a password manager. And, you know, one of the things that people have mentioned to me in conversation is, as well, you know, I don't want all my passwords in the one place. You don't have to put every single password you have in there, but for once, for your day-to-day stuff that you would ideally like to not have breached, but if it is, it's not a life-ending scenario, just use a password manager. I promise you it'll make your life infinitely easier.
You heard it, folks. So with that being said, we will now say goodbye, and until next time, stay secure.
Thank you for listening to the Advanced Persistent Security Podcast. Until next time, stay secure, and don't forget to subscribe to this podcast.